My body hated life.
Yeah, it's you know, it's hard to record when you're in and out of the hospital all the time. So
welcome back. You have to apologize to the audience.
I'm not apologizing.
Hey, I'm sorry. I'm dying.
I'm not apologizing for shit.
I can't help that I was in the hospital, you bitch.
All right, and we're back. Episode 132/episode 1 of season, I think it's 3, because we've had another break. I don't know. We don't really do seasons. We just, our lives blow up and we just stop recording for a while.
And, you know, as much as you plan to not, then things happen. So it becomes longer. It's 2 months later, we're here.
And it's I'm Sorry With the Podcast. We're back, bitches.
That's Christina, if you forgot.
Yeah, that's me. I'm not me. I'm Mrs. Iglesias.
And I am.
That's Amanda.
Amanda.
That's Amanda. Hey, that's Amanda.
That's me. I'm Amanda. Maybe sometimes, some days.
Some days.
We're already starting strong. It's gonna be like getting back on a bike, okay, guys?
It's rusty. We're rusty. Oh, I forgot to take my birth control too.
Dude, take all your pills.
All my pills, because I'm 97 years old, and that's what's keeping me alive.
It's what's keeping her sitting up so we can record all of her pills.
Just propped up here, strapped to a chair, because I can't sit up. No, I'm just kidding.
So tell the world what's wrong. Well, not exactly what's wrong, but
that's
what's
part of the problem.
what the issue is.
I just randomly woke up one day with extreme excruciating abdominal pain, and I have been poked and prodded and scanned and probed, and
you've been camered up, down, and all the way through.
Yes. Up, down, all around town, and they still can't tell me what the fuck is wrong. My gallbladder is apparently fine, except the pain is right above my gallbladder, and I feel like it's just shy and not showing itself on camera to be angry and upset, because she's a cranky bitch, I think, because it's just a lot of pain. And I've been in and out of the emergency room like 4 times, so now I'm marked as a frequent flyer, so when I go into the emergency room, they're like, there's nothing wrong with you, and they won't treat me at all.
Oh,
so that's fun. And then the one time I went in, it was because my ovaries and my abdominal pain was like meshing together to create a gorgeous symphony of pain.
A symphony all the way around.
So yeah, they don't know what's wrong with me.
So yeah, we don't know.
We don't know. Still in pain. Not as bad as it was, but it's just kind of hanging out as like a low burning ache in my right side of my stomach. So any doctors out there want to take a guess? It's not my gallbladder. It's not my pancreas. It's not my liver. It's not my kidneys.
Maybe her uterus, but not her uterus.
It's not my uterus up in the upper right. I may have. They've discovered other issues, which is fun. So much fun. But
well, I mean, they're doing the deduction method.
Oh, and then I got shingles because I was so stressed out that my body said, you know what, let's dig deep inside and find the chicken pox virus that you had at 6 months old and they weren't even sure you had, and let's fucking explode it through your whole body.
So it's been
fun. I've had a lot of fucking fun.
Well, and then once you were feeling better, both of us had no voice.
Nope. And then so I got sick. Yeah. And then I was like, okay, I can kind of function. And then I got a sinus infection and an upper respiratory infection. So I was like, cool. My body literally hates me.
It's kind of, I'm still like fighting it. I didn't get tested, but I'm pretty sure I had COVID again. Because, or there's this rhinovirus that's kind of like mimicking COVID.
It was probably the rhinovirus because that's what I had. Because I tested myself for COVID like 3 times. And because I started with a hacking cough. And I was like, where is this coming from? And then it just kind of turned into a sinus infection.
And I didn't test for it because I'm like, I've already had my symptoms for over 5 days.
Right.
By the time I was like, oh, I think this is whatever. So I'm like, at that point I test and I'm just it's been 5 days already, and that's their like go-to now. So I'm like, okay, well, I guess we'll just not. And if I can't handle it, then I can't handle it, and I won't go to work and I won't do my things. And I only work 3 days a week. So I'm like, I'll just rest the days I'm not.
Of course.
Is it your sister?
Yeah.
It's the first fucking time we've recorded in 2 months. And she still manages to call while we're recording.
And now I gotta get you back because it like bounced away.
Oh yeah, it's connected to your pooter. Nope.
Nope. Sorry, I didn't mean to kick you out of our recording.
I was like, what? Oh. I tried to rejoin the actual meeting ID so that we could just like continue, and then it wouldn't let me.
That's because I closed it. Because I was like, I don't know if she can rejoin, and I don't know how to re-ask her to come back.
Hey, come back.
The boats. Come back. Where were we?
I don't know. We're back. That's basically it.
My body was falling apart, and we're planning for Amanda's
a wedding and bachelorette party.
Mm-hmm. Very exciting stuff.
I last night I had my shingles was like, I don't know if I got like too sweaty during the day walking around shopping and stuff, but like was really irritated and was like, I cannot get sick again. I can't go into the hospital again. Like, we've got shit to do now. So
gonna have to just
buckle down.
I'm either gonna survive or die in my house because I don't got health insurance. I can't go anywhere right now. What are some witchy homemade remedies to fix me?
I'm just gonna burn sage and hope for the best. And my mom goes, maybe you need to go to church. I was like, is that what it is? Do you think there's a demon inside me?
Do an egg cleanse?
Yeah.
Just rub it all over you.
Maybe I should do that. Just do an egg.
Give it a go.
Just give it a go. Just do an egg cleanse.
The fuck is it going to hurt at this point?
I wake up some internal demon inside me. It just makes everything worse.
You start waking up to like a black shadow over your bed. You're like, what happened?
What happened? Well, what happened was,
I was living inside of you, and now I'm out.
Welcome to the party.
Oh, good gravy.
Fuck my life, right? Just kidding. Well, yay, life.
Yay, life. Well, I suppose we could probably tell stories, huh? Unless they just want to hear us talk all day, because we probably could do that, too.
We probably could. The best way to not is to not, though. So let's just crack into it.
Deal. You want to tell me a story?
Boy, howdy do I.
That was nice.
I don't know. I've never said that before in my life. So it
just happened.
It's a first for everybody. All right. I'm going to tell you about the Stott family murders.
Stott?
Yeah. Are you ready?
I'm ready.
So Diane, starting off
to a good start,
starting off good. Diane and Mark Stott were high school sweethearts. And the couple then bought a small 900 square foot, this tiny house in Springfield to raise their four children.
Springfield what?
Why would you ask me that?
Because you didn't say.
It's because I accidentally deleted the state like I always do. So just let me go ahead and Google it quick. I don't know why I always do that to myself and then you always ask.
Well, it's because I want to know.
I know. It was, where is it?
I want to know everything.
Missouri.
I'm like, especially Springfield is in like 9 of the states.
Listen.
Or more.
Springfield, Missouri. Sorry.
Cool.
Okay. Good talk. So by all accounts, the family was happy. They were musically talented and enjoyed religious-themed contemporary music. Diane was a church organist and trained nurse, and also the main source of income for the family, while Mark was the lead singer and guitarist of a local blues band called Messing with Destiny. And he brought home like minimal income and wasn't like the breadwinner, wasn't very helpful around the house kind of thing.
Deadbeat-ish.
I don't want to say deadbeat-ish.
I don't want to say that.
Because he was murdered. But he would take odd jobs, but didn't really like...
Never had a steady income.
Right, and wasn't very helpful around the house kind of thing. But then in April of 2012, tragedy struck. Diane found Mark dead in the family home when she came home from work. At the time, she described Mark's lifestyle as partying more, drinking heavily, and getting into drugs. His bandmates, however, said that Mark would not have gotten into drugs, nor was he a heavy drinker, because it would have caused issues with his voice and harmonica playing in the blues band.
Okay.
There were reports that Mark was feeling unwell, clammy, acting off for weeks, and despite the death being sudden, since Mark didn't lead a very healthy lifestyle, his death was ruled to be of natural causes.
Okay.
So, Diane received $20,000 due to Mark's life insurance policy and was able to move her family to a new neighborhood and into a much larger home.
Okay.
At the time of their father's death, the four children were living in the family home. It was Sean Stott, age 26, who was on the autism spectrum. Sarah Stott, age 24, who was a university graduate with high grades, but an inability to secure any employment and had incurred a high amount of student loan debt.
Mm.
Rachel Stott, age 22, she was like the golden child.
Oh.
She had high marks in college. And her mom, basically the only child her mother ever posted about on Facebook and how amazing she was Rachel.
Oh, nice. Nice.
And then Brianna Stott, age 9, who had severe learning disabilities.
Okay. So we got mom, 3 adult children, and then a 9-year-old in the house. Okay.
So then that September, tragedy struck again when Sean, 26, died suddenly. Sean was diagnosed with autism when he was younger and had a history of seizures, but was found with a ring of blood around his mouth. But his death was ruled to be caused by prior medical issues.
Okay.
Diane told police that Sean had been experiencing flu-like symptoms, diarrhea, nausea, body aches, and headaches for 3 weeks prior to his death. Like his father, Sean's body was also cremated, and he died just 147 days after his father.
He was having all those symptoms for 3 weeks and they didn't go to the doctor?
No.
That's weird to me. Even with no health insurance, if I was having diarrhea for 3 weeks, I'd go to the doctor. I'm just saying.
Sometimes you gotta bite the bullet.
Sometimes you just have to do it, all right?
So as time passed, things seemed to return to normal in the Stott home until June of 2013. So that was 2012 when all of that happened.
So who else died now? I am suspicious of this mother.
You should be. Then Diane rushed her daughter, Sarah, to the emergency room. Sarah, who was then 24 years old, was admitted with flu-like symptoms and her kidney and brain were failing.
Oh, no.
The Springfield Police Department then would receive a tip from someone who claimed to be close to the Stott family. The tipster told them that there had been 2 deaths in the family, and now Sarah was in grave condition with no prior health problems. Diane also seemed almost void of emotion about her daughter's condition. The tipster later came forward as being the pastor of their church.
Wow. You know, you got to be suspicious when mm-hmm. your pastor's like, I don't know, that's not right.
So after the anonymous tip came in claiming Diane was involved, Springfield detective Neil McAmis he started looking closely at the reports filed on Mark and Sean's death and noticed similarities. So they both actually died with a bloody ring around their mouth.
Okay.
And both kind of had the same symptoms, and mm-hmm. then they both died suddenly. When he went to the hospital where Sarah was being treated and talked to the nursing staff, they reported that Diane was behaving strangely, joking about her daughter's condition, and talking about an upcoming vacation to Florida.
Wow.
What was even more concerning was that Sarah's doctor told detectives that they were unable to figure out what exactly was afflicting her, and they were beginning to suspect that she had been poisoned.
Sounds like it.
So Detective McAmis decided that it was time to speak with Diane, and he brought her in for questioning. During the interview, Diane seemed extremely calm, but Detective McAmis was trying to be very careful throughout the interview, because obviously if she didn't do anything, you're dealing with a mother who has lost her husband.
Yeah, lots of trauma.
Son, and now a daughter is severely, severely ill. As the interview progressed, though, things weren't really adding up. So Detective McAmis kind of pressed a little harder, and cracks kind of started to appear in Diane's story. So she at first admitted that she thought her daughter Sarah was difficult, and she may have delayed bringing her to the hospital, but denied harming her or harming Sean. But then she started bringing up antifreeze. Just.
You're just going to bring that up? All right.
Mm-hmm. She said, "I didn't hurt my kids, and that's what I feel like you're insinuating I did. I may not be the best mother in the world, but I didn't hurt my kids." I think she said it was like, it's not like I put antifreeze or something in. Like, it was very like, are you sure about that?
That's a weird detail to volunteer, even when you're just denying something.
Right. And then she also said that when Mark died, it was a relief. She didn't tell people that, but she didn't know what else to say. So she like basically was not happy with Mark.
Right.
At this point in questioning, the interrogation tapes show that Diane wondering out loud if she needed a lawyer, and McAmis then basically read her rights.
Mm-hmm.
And Diane continued to talk. Diane at first said that Mark and Sean were drinking antifreeze as a way to commit suicide. So maybe they drank antifreeze to commit suicide. But then she eventually confessed she was the one giving it to them without their knowledge.
You are a loiterer.
What shocked the detectives more than the act was the reason behind it. Diane at first said that Mark and Sean were drinking, obviously, suicide, but then she confessed that she just said that she hated Mark. Her words were she hated his guts. And then she talked about Sean as being just a heavy burden because of his autism. And that her exact words were that he was the worst pest.
Oh my, I'm this bitch.
And then with Sarah, she said Sarah had student loans that needed to be paid, and Sarah wasn't working and couldn't keep a job, and she just needed to get her out of the way.
She has what? She has no, this is her family.
Yeah.
I'm like, Mark, okay, divorce him. He's not bringing in any, you're paying for everything anyway. Divorce him. Be like, hey, see you later, bud. But your kids, come on.
So then Diane was immediately taken into custody. So while she was taken into custody, police executed a search warrant on the house to try and like find evidence.
Mm-hmm.
And in the house, they found a diary.
Always keep a diary.
Just wait. Okay. The small purple diary belonged to Rachel. And the contents inside it were more than very concerning.
Mm-hmm.
She detailed out the upcoming deaths of her father and brother months before they actually died. She wrote that she knew it was happening and that she was trying to come to terms with it. It was time, and that so when they found that, they're like, okay, now we have to question Rachel, because was she a part of this?
Right.
So Rachel, who was at the time 22 years old, said the only person her mom talked to about harming was herself, but then she changed her story after the detectives were like, yeah, that's not true, we found your diary. So she said, and then they also found a note that was discovered in Rachel's purse, which Rachel had written a bizarre poem, and that ended with, "Only the quiet ones will be left, my mother, my little sister, and me."
What the fuck?
Yes. And then her diary entry in complete said, "It's sad when I realized how my father will pass on in the next 2 months. Sean, my brother, will move on shortly after. It will be tough getting used to the changes, but everything will work out." And it was dated June 13th, 2011, which was a year before Rachel's dad died.
Yeah. Wow.
When confronted with that evidence, Rachel told McAmis the entry was about bad dreams she had about them dying. But after McAmis read Rachel her Miranda rights, she then confessed that she and her mother had researched different options to kill her father, including suffocation and a cocktail of pills before settling on antifreeze. She said her mother bought the antifreeze online because antifreeze sold in stores has added a bittering agent to prevent accidental ingestion. Because in general, you could put it in something and you couldn't taste it. She wanted a specifically tasteless one.
Wow.
She said the plan was to poison her father, but her mother quickly turned her attention on Sean, and Rachel said she reluctantly went along. Sean, we argued a lot about because I still think, she said, Sean, we argued a lot about because I still think we could have put him in an assisted living, but she just wanted him out. Rachel then also said Sarah is equally unneeded. We could have found someplace else for her, but she was very adamant that Sarah was just a burden, that Sarah needed to be taken care of.
Wow.
So in further interrogation, Rachel told McAmis that she and her mother only took her sister Sarah to the hospital because she worried about the smell that would be left afterwards if she died in the house.
I'm speechless. Wow.
Her exact quote was, I didn't want another one to die in the house because houses are nasty after somebody's died in it.
Okay.
She also said, I get a lot of nightmares. After Sean died, I moved into his room and it was awful, just awful in there. I kept feeling things in there. I just didn't want that again. Maybe because you fucking murdered your brother.
Right.
It's weird.
Oh my God.
Rachel then also said that despite what her mother had said, her then 12-year-old sister was next after Sarah.
What?
I know there was no way in hell I'd be able to take care of her. I can't even take care of me. And I know my mom had no interest in taking care of her.
Well, then you're going to be after that, obviously.
Mm-hmm. No, holy because shit. She was the golden child. It was just going to be her and her mom.
Well, yeah, but until she gets sick of having to deal with her for whatever reason, apparently this is what she just does.
Rachel also said that her mother was the only one that understood her. They related to each other. She was the golden child, and it was just going to be those two together.
I don't know.
Mm-hmm. So Diane Stott was sentenced to life in prison without the possibility of parole in 2016, while Rachel Stott pled guilty to second-degree murder in May of 2015 as part of a plea deal in exchange for testifying against her mother at her trial, eventually being sentenced in March of 2016 to life in prison with the possibility of parole.
Okay.
Both Rachel and Diane have since appealed to vacate their pleas, with Rachel arguing, when lawyers were appointed, my fear of men was not accommodated, leading to miscommunication, coercion, and mental duress. Being in an interview room alone with a male detective was like being flayed alive. You should be flayed alive, you dumb bitch.
There's so many things that I want to say, but don't know how to say. Okay, go on.
So, and then just so you know, Brianna Stott, I don't believe Brianna was her first name. I think that was the name they gave her in the case because she was a minor.
Right, which makes sense.
After the arrest of Diana and Rachel, Brianna, then a fourth grade student and a minor child, had not yet been poisoned by her mother, sister. That was her name. So she has a new name. And that has not been identified by her sources due to her age. And she was placed in foster care.
So just the opposite of it, like that was her name, but now she goes by a different identity. Yes.
Sarah survived, but suffered severe organ damage and neurological damage as a result of the antifreeze. Her symptoms, initially thought to be flu-like, were later revealed to be caused by the poisoning. She maintains a Facebook profile with information about the murder case, as well as a profile banner photo of her father performing in Messing with Destiny. She was given the opportunity to read the statement in court, which said, I prefer to be a survivor than a victim. I forgive my mom for what she did to me, but she not only took away my dad and brother, she took away my lifestyle, livelihood, and my independence. Sarah, who had been on the dean's list during her years in university, was said by Greene County prosecuting attorney to require a guardian and living in an assisted living facility. due to the effects of the poison on her body and her mental state.
Right. Oh, poor girl. That's just, wow. Is that it?
Yeah.
Wow.
It's fucked up.
I don't even know. I can't imagine.
It reminds me of the other case I did. I can't remember which one it was, but it was the mother was poisoning her family. She killed her father. And then she killed, I think, another child. And then she tried to kill her other daughter of alcohol poisoning and left a suicide note.
Mm.
I did that one, I don't know, probably a year ago.
But it is really wild how, like, I couldn't remember or tell you cases that we've covered unless I look at pictures of, like, that visual memory helps me. But, like, I can pull out facts and then I'm like, I don't know what case it is, but I remember hearing it.
But I was just like, that's so fucked up. That's so fucked
up. Wow. You can tell that we haven't been telling each other, and I haven't been, like, researching as much, because I'm kind of flabbergasted, and it's weird how after we do it every week for so long, I don't realize how
you're desensitized to it.
Yeah. How much I don't feel it. And was that you?
It was me. Sorry.
Okay. I was like, hello?
The fuck was that?
But yeah, it's kind of wild thinking about that, because right now I'm just kind of overwhelmed with.
Mm-hmm. Sorry.
No, it's fine, with just, like, trying to not empathize, but sympathize in a way where it's like, okay, so how would you get to that point?
I know.
But then at the same, you can't. Okay, well, thanks for that.
You're welcome.
Well,
and tell me your depressing story. Let's go.
Ah, Roy. All right, so I'm going to tell you the story of Sophie Toscan du Plantier. It's French, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
And it's Plantier. And I really wanted to say it, and I looked it up. Plantier.
Plantier.
Because I'm smart. So
she's a French bitch.
That's a French ass name.
That's a Plantier. That's a French ass name, Yvonne.
My little croissant. My little croissant. The back of your head is ridiculous. So Sophie was born July 28th of 1957 in Paris, France.
Paris.
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 I can't hear you from back there, girl.
I know. I gotta lean forward every time I wanna talk.
She was a documentary producer. There we go. I was going to say documentarian.
She's a documentary. Pronounce every single syllable in the word.
Documentary producer. And through this work, she met her husband, Daniel Toscan du Plantier. Whoa. It's just a mouthful. She had a son before this marriage from a previous marriage, but nothing I could find detailed anything in the past. So Daniel was a British film producer, her new husband, and was famous, and they became romantic in 1988. Daniel was 16 years older than Sophie and was married two times before her, but he also was, like, part of that movie lifestyle. So he would go to parties. He was very social, whatever. And that doesn't really help marriages unless you guys can come to terms with what your differences are, you know?
Yeah.
So I'm guessing that's what's happened to him. Mm-hmm. On June 18th, 1991, the two were married. And Daniel was all about the fame. He loved the social life, like I said, and he was all about going out, being seen, looking cute, looking all good.
Glitz and glam. Mm-hmm.
Sophie was much more of a homebody. She was much more laid back, would do it and enjoyed it, but she would much rather be home.
Mm-hmm.
And in 1993, Sophie actually bought a holiday home in West Cork, Ireland. Because she went there when she was, like, in high school and her early 20s and just kind of fell in love with the countryside there. So she bought this little holiday home, and it was basically just her extremely remote house that she would go to when she needed to just be away from all of the fame-y stuff that she had to deal with on a daily basis.
I want a house in Ireland that I can just go to when people piss me off.
Right? That's what I'm saying. And I mean, a lot of times...
Hashtag dream.
Right? A lot of times she'd bring her son with her and she'd do like long weekends or whatever and they'd just go relax.
Mm-hmm.
Just before Christmas, Sophie decided... this was 1993, I believe. Oh, no. Oh, no, my table is broken. Oh, 96. So 3 years.
Okay.
3 years after that. I didn't put the date until later on. I'm like, wait, I don't understand. Okay. Anyway, just before Christmas, Sophie decided to take a retreat to this house. And she had asked on December 19th, asked around to see if anybody would want to come with her and just do like a quick vacation before they had the Christmas stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But because it was right before Christmas, everybody had their things they were trying to get ready for or whatever, so she couldn't really find anybody to come with her, so she's like, fine, I'll just do a solo trip. So she arrived in Ireland the morning of December 20th 1996, with plans to be back in Paris by Christmas. So she was just going to spend a few days and then come back. She rented a Ford Fiesta when she arrived and drove it to her home in West Cork. She stopped at the Texaco gas station, which I was surprised to hear that there's those in Ireland.
Mm-hmm. Texaco.
Yeah. I read it and I was like, Texaco?
Texaco, huh? All right.
All right, cool. On the way to buy firewood for her burning stuff. and she stopped at a local place for lunch between 3:30 and 4:30 p.m. So she was obviously just whenever she got there, she ate.
Okay.
And then she went home. When she got there, she called the caretaker to get the information she needed to know, because she had someone who stayed there when she wasn't there, or checked on the place, made sure everything was being kept up. And so, you know, give me information. Is there something that I need to watch for? Is everything working good? Yada, yada. The next day she drove to town to get groceries and got money at an ATM. When that day she got home at 4:30 as well. And this was also the last time that she was seen like outside the house and the premises. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Later in the evening, she did call her husband, but he missed the call and called her back around 11 p.m. because he was working.
Okay.
And so they had a conversation and he said that she seemed normal, didn't seem worried or upset, or didn't say anything about anything, right? On December 22nd, Sophie visited the ruins of Donlu. I don't know what it is, but sounds cool. Sounds like something I'd go to. That same day, she visited a friend and had told her that she was at the ruins, and while she was there, there was a woman who kind of freaked her out. She, quote, said, "Oh my God, I saw a woman like a white shape." A ghost is what I kind of took that. The Lady of the Lake, quote unquote, which is a folklore tale from around there. And in this folklore tale, when you see the Lady of the Lake,
you're going to die.
You're going to die soon. So
creepy.
December 23rd, around 10 a.m., Sophie's body was found. So the next day, that kind of freaks me out. Body was found outside on the lane or the driveway of her home. Shirley Foster, her neighbor, is the one who found her. She was on a walk. She was wearing a white top, lycra leggings, and boots. So I had to look up what lycra was, because I was like, that's a word you don't hear a lot.
Yeah.
It's kind of like that spandexy, it seems like the shiny kind of workout pants, is what I deduced from my pictures I saw.
You are correct.
Thank you.
Dang out.
I mean, it was the 90s. Lycra was a thing.
Yeah.
Step aerobics videos. The
80s. Yeah, booty.
They and her clothes were caught up in the barbed wire fence that surrounds her property. Clearly, she had been murdered.
Mm-hmm. She had numerous defensive wounds. She was beaten severely around her head and on her upper body. Amanda, hello.
Ouch.
And it looked like the injuries were caused by something like a fire poker. So a long cylindrical hard object. There was also a concrete block that was at the scene that seemed to be the one that that was dropped on her head. While she was on the ground, she was laying in a pool of her own blood. So there was blood found on the gate. So clearly she had been killed right there. There was no moving the body, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Inside the house, there was no sign of anything out of the ordinary. There was no sign of a break-in. Nothing was turned up. There was no looking for something robbery-esque. The bed was unmade and there were two wine glasses in the drying rack next to the sink though. So either she had wine twice and just didn't use the same glass, or there was a second person there having wine with her, was kind of what they looked at. There was no luck with fingerprinting. They found nothing that wasn't hers. There was a bloody hair found in her hands, and it was found to be her own hair when they tested it.
Weird.
So I don't know what happened. No DNA evidence anywhere. They found nothing that proved anybody else had been there other than the fact that she was beaten.
Weird.
Yeah. The front doors, the front and back doors had all also been latched, so they were locked when they went to go investigate. The gate at the end of the driveway was wide open, though, when all of her neighbors said she would usually keep it closed, so that was a little weird.
Mm-hmm.
Police theorized that she was maybe attacked in her house and ran to escape, and when she ran down the drive, she tripped when she was trying to climb over the fence and got caught in the barbed wire fence, and that's when the killer caught up with her.
Okay.
Since she was found near briars, the spiky plants,
mm-hmm.
Police were aware that the killer may be scratched up and have some, on top of maybe some defensive wounds, but they'd be scratched up from climbing through them in order mm-hmm. to get to her. Following the discovery, they went door to door and did interviews with all of the neighbors in the surrounding area, handing out questionnaires, trying to narrow things down a little bit, see if anybody saw anything. December 27th, so we're talking 4 days after she was discovered, Marie Farrell, a local shop owner, said that she saw Sophie in her shop on December 21st around 3 p.m. She also said that she saw a man that was standing outside of the shop wearing a long black coat. And when Sophie left, he seemed to follow her or left at the same time. And apparently it was enough to make note in this woman's head.
Mm-hmm.
So she called in the tip. January 11th, 1997, so about a month later, authorities got a call from a woman calling herself Fiona. She said that she had seen a man in Kilafata.
It's not correct, but okay.
K-E-A-L-F-A-D-D-A.
I have no fucking clue. I don't speak Celtic, but I know that Kilafata is not how they say it.
I don't know. But at this bridge, around 3 a.m. the night that Sophie was murdered, this was about 2.5 kilometers from her house. The woman said nothing else to the police, and they traced the call to a public payphone, so they didn't know who this woman was. There was an appeal to the public made asking for Fiona, the one who called, to come to them and give them more information about this man that she saw.
Mm-hmm.
And the next day she called in again. Okay. And they told them about that night. And she also called from a public payphone booth at that point as well. So they couldn't trace who she was, where she was coming from. January 24th. So we are officially 1 month past her body being found.
Mm-hmm.
Fiona, quote unquote, called again and said she couldn't meet them. She couldn't meet them about the sighting, but this call was traced to Marie Farrell's house this time. So the same woman who called in saying she saw her in the shop and she was followed by a man. They were one in the same. I don't know why I wrote that at the end of that paragraph, but I did.
Theatrical.
It sounds like a bad script for like a true crime. They were one
in the same.
Dun, dun, dun.
Dun, dun, dun.
So she told them that she didn't want to give a public statement because she was out with another man the night that she witnessed this other guy on the bridge.
Oh, shit.
And she was married. So she was like, I don't really want to like say out loud that I was the person.
Yeah.
She said that the man on the bridge seemed drunk, that he was kind of wobbling around and just kind of off. And he started waving his arms around, trying to catch their attention. She also said that she saw a man, the same man, in January again at a supermarket. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
She's like, apparently she saw his face close enough to be able to see him at the supermarket and put them together. This man was Ian Bailey. Okay. So Ian Bailey was a journalist living in Skull, Ireland. I want to live in Skull, Ireland.
Skull. It's probably pronounced like school. Or
yeah, something. Right. But it's cool.
But I'm gonna say Skull.
He worked as a freelance journalist and met and moved in with an artist named Jules. Okay. He had a history of domestic violence with Jules. And in 2001, he was actually convicted of assault as well.
Mm-hmm.
So he has a little bit of a violent
temper.
I wouldn't say past because this was like 97 and it was 2001 mm-hmm. that he was charged with assault, but Bailey just happened to be the first journalist that's on Sophie's crime scene too. What?
Surprise, surprise.
Yeah. He said he got a call from a reporter named Eddie Cassidy about the murder of a foreign journalist.
Mm-hmm.
And both Bailey and Jules went straight to the crime scene after this call, he says. There was a local that said that at 11:45, Bailey had told them that he was covering the murder of a French woman. Mm-hmm. So this was 3 hours before she was even technically discovered, or right after she was discovered. That's what it was. An hour after she was discovered, because it was right around 10 a.m.
Suspicious.
Yeah, so it shouldn't even be known quite yet. So this was not known to the media or police yet that she was French. They didn't really know who she was. They were still just getting there, found a body, figuring out who lived in the house, yada, yada. So it's weird that he knew the French detail as well. Bailey said Eddie said that she was French. So Eddie's the culprit, whoever this Eddie guy is. But Eddie denies knowing that. He said that all he said was she was a nationalist. She was from a different country. She, you know, mm-hmm. all we know is that she's someone who's visiting, basically, is all right. He knew. Bailey wrote multiple articles on the murder. Weird. With details that weren't known to the public.
How'd you know that, fool?
Did Eddie tell you that, too?
Did fucking Bailey? Eddie tell you?
And I put suspicious.
Don't be suspicious.
Be suspicious.
You're suspicious. That's suspicious.
He also claimed that the victim had multiple male companions with no real evidence of that. I think trying to make it seem more fantastic than maybe it was, mm-hmm. if that's the case. Said in France she had multiple male companions, which was not proven at all, and that they may have killed her, trying to point the finger elsewhere.
Mm-hmm.
Several people said that Bailey had scratches on his arms the days following the murder. Those damn briars. Bailey explained that these... Sorry, I forgot about this detail. Bailey explained the cuts by saying that he was cutting down a Christmas tree. And supposedly he had climbed to the top of a pine tree to cut the top off of it as his Christmas tree and fell down on his way back down. And that's how he got the scratch.
I can't. That's the stupidest fucking made up bullshit I've ever heard in my entire life.
And then he also had scratches on like his forehead area, right? Mm-hmm. And the way he said he got those is that he was trying to kill three turkeys. What?
So fucking dumb.
So he and Jules were arrested for the murder on February 10th, so about 2 months after the discovery of the body. When questioned of their whereabouts, he said he went to a pub with Jules, and when they got home around 12:30, they slept until morning, and Jules agreed. She's like, yeah, that's what we did. At first. She then said, well, he may have gotten out of bed around about an hour later. Then in the morning, he had scratches on his forehead that he didn't have before. What? No. So Bailey changed his story and said, yes, he had gotten out of bed, but it was at 4 a.m. to work on something for about 30 minutes. And then he came back to bed because he was doing a journalist thing. I don't know. He had a dream or something.
Doubt it.
That's what I'm saying. They were later released with no charges because there wasn't really anything connecting them conclusively other than
objects
maybe left.
Say just a lot of hearsay.
Mm-hmm. There would be people later who would come forward saying that Bailey had confessed to them that he had done the murder. A 14-year-old Malachi Reed came out on February 4th, so right around when they got arrested, which I'm wondering if this is like why they officially got arrested to get questioned in that way. Because he came forward and said that Bailey was giving him a lift home, and Bailey confessed to him that he went up there with a rock and bashed her fucking brains out. Quote. He also confessed to a couple people in 1998, so the next year after he was released because they didn't have enough evidence. I did it. I went too far. And then, so that's a quote that they said he had said. Mm-hmm. Then in 1998, he was arrested once again for the murder, but again was released because, again, they didn't have enough physical anything to link him. Marie Farrell This makes no sense. I'm going to just do a little quick glancy glance and try to put it back together in a real sentence. So Marie Farrell has now announced publicly that he is the man that she saw on the bridge. Bailey's that guy. She was harassed by him. And then in 2004, Bailey threatened legal action against her to retract her statement. Mm-hmm. And she was like, okay. Because in 2005, she did retract her statement, claiming that she was coerced by the police to say that it was Bailey for some reason, even though she's the one who named him.
Right.
In 2010, a French magistrate issued a warrant for Bailey's arrest, but Ireland wouldn't extradite. So because it was a French citizen who got killed, they were like, well, we're going to try to do something about it since it's not getting done in Ireland. But they wouldn't send him. And in 2019, he was tried in a French court, finally, in absentia. That's what it was, absentia, and was found guilty and sentenced to 25 years in prison in May of 2019. So he can't really do it, but if he ever comes to France, they're putting him in jail.
Right.
Bailey's still free in Ireland and swears that he's innocent, and the case technically remains unsolved.
That's such bullshit.
Even though Ireland
is a non-extradition country. Mm-hmm. So if ever I commit a crime, that's where I'm fucking going.
Bingo bango, going to Ireland.
Bingo bango, going to Ireland.
But yeah, and that's the sad, weird, unfortunate,
fucked up case.
I just like can't imagine that, because they arrested him twice. Like clearly there was enough for them to feel like they could maybe get a confession or something with him. Right. But he, nope. Well, now we have to let you go because it's been this, 72 hours or whatever it is. They can only hold you if you're arrested without charges.
Mm-hmm.
So, I don't know. And I don't know, maybe it wasn't him because there wasn't any connection other than this Marie Farrell saying she saw him on a bridge.
And all the scratches.
And the scratches on him. But like at the same time, I wasn't at the questioning, so I don't know how much they like pushed to say, well, are you sure he didn't like come back after being gone somewhere? Are you sure?
Are you sure?
You know, so I'm like, what happened and why? It's like her quiet place and that's where she gets...
No, that was wholly unsatisfying. Thank you.
I know. You're welcome. Unfortunately, I wish there was more to it, but there really isn't. I don't like unsolved, but at the same time, I find it interesting because then you can kind of, it leaves it open to discuss what possibilities are. Oh, good gravy, child.
Good gravy, child.
Yep. So that's been my saying at work. Oh, good gravy, child. And it's really funny when you hear like a 2.5-year-old say it to another child because they've heard you say it enough. They're like, good gravy.
I took Tessa to the zoo over Memorial Day weekend.
Mm-hmm.
And she was climbing up on one of the walls of the exhibit. And I'm pretty sure it was for the gorilla exhibit. And I went, hey, get off there. We don't need another Harambe. And she like turns around and like stops down. And I hear a dad just start laughing behind me. And he's like, that's my kind of parenting.
I'm just saying.
Just saying, I don't need another Harambe. Get down.
Hey, don't be the reason for another Harambe. All right.
Get down. And she does. She's like, what? And I'm like, just get down. Stop climbing on the exhibits.
Oh, that's funny. Oh, well, this was fun.
Glad I got to see your veins.
I know. I miss you.
I miss you, too. 3 weeks.
3 weeks. I got some work to do.
Oh, yeah. Let's jiggle, jiggle. My body don't jiggle, jiggle.
It falls.
My body do jiggle, jiggle.
That's Kate. So sweet. Even after having a child, she's like, I have like one stretch mark because I was talking about something and she goes, yeah, I got my first non-maturing stretch marks over the last 2 years, right? And she's like, she shows me this little tiny thing. I'm like, that's not even a stretch mark, that's just like a vein.
Get out of here.
I'm like, I'm a tiger on my tummy now.
Get the fuck out of here.
Sweet. Oh, sweet child.
Oh, good gravy child.
Good gravy child. So, oh, okay. We're going to end this and then I'll talk to you about it.
Okay.
Okay. Well,
how do we end these? Spread the word?
Oh, spread yourselves.
Thanks. As well.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Spread the gravy. Ew.
Ew. Keep your gravy to yourself. No snail trails anywhere. Get out of here. And with that, I'm out. Goodbye.
Bye.